Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith.
Hi.
By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous room's full of people like you and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any dope since May the 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be sober. I'm glad to see some of my old friends, Bob, and a few of the people that we've known around here, some of the speakers, and it's a privilege to be asked to come and participate in any program. I'm glad, Sue, my wife, gets to go with me a lot. We get to travel together, do a lot of these things, and you know, the book tells us that we're supposed to share what it used to be like and what happened and how little we've changed. That's basically what it's all about. I mean, if I hadn't changed a little, well, I wouldn't have been here, but I ain't changed a whole lot. I got up yesterday morning at 4 o'clock and simulated work for a while, and messed around for a little while, not figuring on doing much until it was time to come here. And then midnight last night, while we went to LAX, Los Angeles, and got on an airplane, flew 4.5 hours for an hour's worth of vicarious pleasure. I ain't slept since 4 o'clock yesterday morning, I don't think. If I did, why, I wasn't sure of it. And that's basically, you know, how I live my life. I've always been that way. I would be willing to travel to any length in order to be where it's happening. And I'll sleep when I get to heaven. I can say that positively. But that's really it. I mean, that's the whole deal. I've been that way all my life. I'm not one of those people that come to Alcoholics Anonymous, sobered up, and went back to school and got a PhD and, you know, have a success story to tell you about how I started my own business and became a millionaire. I did, sobriety has taught me one thing. A spiritual entity of this program is that the California Lotto is going to be about $23 million today. And I asked God if I could handle that, if I won it. And he told me I should buy one ticket. That's all I should buy, just one. That if he wants me to win it, if he thinks I'm, you know, capable of handling $23 million, why, one ticket's enough. So I stopped by and bought five. Just in case, you know. One for him and four for me, you know. Let him have the quick pick. You know, I mean, that just, that ain't never going to change. I'm always going to be like that. I am always going to be like that. I want the deal. I want the deal. I've always wanted the deal. I want to be where the deal is. I love the deal. Deal me in. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. I want to be there. I want to be where life is in session. And, the amazing thing about that is that, I guess it's just our perspective about where that is and what's happening. Because today I really believe that I'm where it's what, you know, where life is in session. I get to travel a lot and I do a lot of things in life. I don't miss much. I'm out there on the streets from the time I get up in the morning to the time I shut her down at night. I'm out there with the people that are doing things, not only in Alcoholics Anonymous, but in life itself. And my perspective of life today has changed as a result of my sobriety. Physically sober, I had to get physically sober before I could observe what was going on and how it was happening and who it was happening with. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was, you know, my whole life had become so much of a tunnel vision that it's like looking through a straw. That's all I could see. Whatever was right under that one little pinpoint tip, that's all that was going on. As a result of staying sober and applying these principles in my life one day at a time, while I've developed some peripheral vision, I've been able to see some things. I've been able to enjoy more. And I believe that if sobriety hadn't been that way for me, I wouldn't have stayed. If I would have had to live under that illusion that, this one path is a rut, which becomes a grave, and eventually you hang pictures on the side of it, and that's it. It's gloom and doom, and, fun time is over, and you're never going to be able to enjoy anything again. I would not have stayed in Alcoholics Anonymous, much less stayed sober. I believe for me life is an experience, and I believe that looking back through a lot of inventory in my life that I don't regret anything I ever did. I don't regret every drink I ever took. Every drink I ever took, I needed it. Every pill I ever popped, every needle I ever slammed, every joint I ever smoked, I did everything but a pap smear. You know, and every bit of that was necessary. I don't regret a damn bit of it, man. I did it with full enthusiasm every time, man. I expected more than whatever it was that I was putting in me was capable of giving me. I never asked what is it going to do to me. I was willing to experience whatever it was that was about to happen. I've always been that way, and I am that way today. And I think one of the greatest gifts that sobriety has given me is that the difference is that I don't really have the fear of what's going to happen, because I have lived a way of life, and I've been, you know, I'm not afraid of going to hell. I've been there. I've been there. Took up residency, by God. Had a home place. I'm out on my green card today. So I'm not afraid of going to hell. I know what it's like to live there for an indefinite period of time. But I tell you something, it isn't that I'm afraid of going back there, it's just that life is so good today that I don't want to leave. And sometimes that's an illusion. And I think that's what we do on occasion when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, come to these conventions. These conventions are roundups are, for me anyway, it's an opportunity to come and hear other people share their experience, strength, and hope. It's an opportunity for me to come and meet people and mingle with people. The book says we are people who normally wouldn't mix. I probably wouldn't have drank with most of you people, much less sell you dope. You know, so I think it's a great opportunity to charge our batteries, to be able to put a little extra icing on the cake so that next Wednesday, whenever the fears and the inadequacies rise up at 2:00 in the morning, while we have something to reach back and draw from, even if it's no more than the fact that you can say, if that sucker can do it, so can I. You know, I mean, most of the time. And that's, you know, if you're looking for any more than that, don't look for something that isn't here, you know. If you're new or relatively new, why look, just experience. Try to let your head and your body get in the same place. When I first sobered up, I spent physically, I was so bad physically that they had to put me in a shake and bake kind of thing. It wasn't any country club type of atmosphere. It was just something. Physically, being very good to myself, I had just damn near killed myself. So they put me in this place with 39 other people. Like me, and Dr. Paul Olliger, whose story's in a big book, the doctor, alcoholic addict, or whatever it is in there, the controversial Dr. Paul O, happened to be the physician in charge of this shake and bake that I went to, and he just started this thing. So I ended up in this place with him, and there was 39 of us drunk in there trying to shake it, and we stayed there for over 30 days. I think they were kind of studying us, you know, to see, like guinea pigs, kind of like a little more of a elevation of sponsorship. You know, a sponsor will tell you to do something, if it works, he'll try it. And so the medicals are right. I ain't gonna blow no bubbles. It's true. If you're new and your sponsor's telling you to do something that seems like it's absolutely impossible to do, use that and get the hell out there and do it and prove that it can be done, and you'll help him. And so I ended up in this detox with these 39, 38 other people, and actually it was one of the first detoxes in California where they would detox people who had alcohol and drug problems. They didn't talk about it. It was kind of a no-no, but they put us in there with this Dr. Paul, and so we were kicking all this stuff. They didn't give us any you know, narcotics to come off. They just walked us up and down the hallway. And for about 20 days, I'd walk up and down the hallway and laugh for three steps and cry for three steps. Absolutely crazy. I had two different groups of people who had contract on my life. So I didn't have a good resume to bring in there, I'll guarantee you. And at the end of this 30-some day period of time where they put us all in a circle and they in chairs in this big room, and they started out on my left, and they let each one of us tell every other individual there, if we choose to, take their inventory. In other words, if you had made a friendship, you could say, I think old Bill's going to make it. I love him. I'm glad he's sober, and I believe when he gets out of here, he's finally found it. And then if they didn't think you were going to make it, they had the privilege of telling you that. And it's funny how God has a sense of humor. They started on my left, which means I was the last one. That could be bad. But as it turned out, every one of those people, 38 people, said something nice or something questionable about the other 38 people. Every one of those people said, Keith's going to drink as soon as he hits the street. Because I had a bad attitude and a rotten disposition and a thirst, a craving, an insane craving for alcohol that did not let up. It was obvious. Everything about me said that. When I was sitting in there trying to detox, I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink. I didn't want to get my wife back, my kid back, my dog back, my cat back, my job back, my money back, my dignity back. I wanted to drink. And that's the way I explained it. And 38 people said, that cat's going to drink. They were so convincing that when it got to 39, I almost said, I'm going to drink. I'm the only one out of 39 that didn't drink. I'm the only one out of 39 that's still sober. And over half of them are dead, and half of the half that's dead died suicide sober. So if you're new, relatively new, you don't have to necessarily go with the vote around here. And I am living proof you can stay sober for at least a year and a half on a resentment. Just out of spite. It almost killed me, but I said, I'll show you. And that's the way I've been all my life. You know, competition is, my second nature. And my drug of choice in sobriety is adrenaline. I just have that insane energy to go and do the things. And those are character defects that have got me in a lot of trouble prior to coming here. I come from a long line of alcoholics. I don't necessarily be necessary for you to come from a lot of alcoholic heritage there, I suppose, in order to be an alcoholic. But I do. That's my story. I come from a lot of different drunks, and most of them are dead. My daddy's a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, and he and I have a good relationship. Most of the other drunks died drunk. Nobody but my daddy and I ever found Alcoholics Anonymous and stayed sober. And I found AA about 14, 15 months before he did. He went through a lot of detoxes and couldn't stay sober because he's smart. You know, he knew everything. And that intellect didn't help him stay sober. He sobered up because I sobered up and stayed sober. And he'll tell you today, that's the only reason he sobered up, because he was always better than me. And that's the only thing that I got on him. I one-upped his ass. And I always wanted to one-up the old man, you know. I didn't know I was going to have to come to AA and sober up. Stay sober over a year in order to beat him, but he'll tell you today. And I believe today. I really believe it, because he and I are that close in the sense of it, is that if I would drink, he'd probably go with me. See? I mean, that'll never change. That's just as true. I know in my own heart, if he drinks, I ain't going to drink with him, because he's smart, and he might make it back, but I'm dumb, and I wouldn't never make it back. If you ever hear I go drink, come looking for me, because I will not come back on my own, see? And that's kind of the family I grew up with. I was born out in Texas. I Don't think that necessarily makes you an alcoholic. It gives me certain characteristics. I've always had the ability to recognize your character defects, and I've always had a need to tell you about it. Yeah. What that did, that made drinking a contact sport. That's what it did. I like to get drunk and talk loud and raise hell. When you can't do nothing else, fight. I like to fight. And some people, it's a funny thing how those emotions affect them differently. Some people, fear will demobilize them and they'll hunker down in the corner like an old mule. And other people, fear, just the fear of fear will mobilize them, and it's like an adrenaline. And I drove fear like a fast car all my life. It was something that I would, I really wouldn't think. Impulsively, I would just react. I would react. And, you know, a moving target's hard to hit, I always figured. And so I just kept her moving, you know, and I'd punch and run. I didn't want to stand there toe. I learned a long time ago, you stand there toe to toe, you might get whooped. You know, you hit them hard and then split. And, you know, or wait around the corner with a two before till they come out of the bar. And, I don't know nothing about being fair. I was born with that intuitively, you know. Just, I had a thing inside of me that is not the size of the man in the fight, it's the size of the fight inside the man. And I had that intuitively. I had a philosophy of life from the very beginning. I don't remember looking through years of inventory. I couldn't tell you. It was almost just like second nature that if you ain't making an enemy a day, you ain't cutting it. And I don't mean making somebody mad enough just to be kind of upset with you. I mean making them mad enough they want to think about you. You control them for at least a month or so. Yeah. And I lived with that philosophy. I hung around with people that were like that. I drank with guys that were just, you know, good old boys. If you got in jail, they'd get you out. And if they couldn't get you out, they'd get in there with you. You can count on it, you know. And I grew up on 3-2 beer and White Lightning. Love that White Lightning. They used to get that White Lightning in them quart fruit jars, and it looked like white gasoline. Had things floating around inside in there, man. It just take your breath away. It just come right out your pores. We used to get an old pickle crock and fill it half full of White Lightning. It's about 190 proof. We'd put about a third of Morgan David wine in there, and a quart of Everclear, and you know, some Welch's grape juice and a chunk of ice. And, the ice didn't last long. We'd hang one of them old dippers in the side of that thing and have a bunch of them tin cups around there, and you'd drink that stuff, and I'll tell you, you drink a couple of cups of that, and you know, the men were men and the sheep were unscared, I'll guarantee it. You know, and I grew up there in the farming country, you know, and I mean, you know, you want to know how I'm doing, I'll tell you, I won this belt buckle in a rodeo. That new pickup truck over there is mine, and honest to God, I was just helping that sheep through the fence, you know. I mean, that's just the way we were. I mean, that's just it. You can take a boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy, and that's the way I was, and, I never intended to do nothing but have a good time, you know. And I did have a good time most of the time, except right in the end, you know. It always, everything I ever did had good intentions. And I went to a little country dance one Saturday night, and I had a run of bad luck there for a little while, and been locked up, and had been divorced, and you know, didn't have a driver's license, didn't have no money, didn't have a job. I was a prime candidate for a pre-Al-Anon. I was just perfect, just ripe. You know, like a tomato, you can tell when they're just ripe for somebody to fix. I had nothing going for me. Absolutely nothing. And I went to this little dance, and I started to fight, and because the band quit playing, so I started to fight, whenever the fight was over, while this lady was standing around there, and I asked her to dance. And she was handy, so I asked her to dance. And since I'm a quick study, I found out in one quick dance that, you know, she had a car, she had a driver's license, she had a job, she had money in the bank, she had a place to stay, she was single, and, you know, I fell in love. Don't take me long. And I asked her, why don't you take me home with you? And she didn't have much going on, and so she said, yeah. And I said, stick with me, baby, and I'll take you places you've never been before. And I did, too. And most of them she didn't want to go, but hell, I took her anyway, you know. And that was over 32 years ago, and we're still together, you know. And she was sitting right there beside me on the plane all night long. She didn't sleep much either. When she did, I woke her up. Didn't want her to miss anything. And we went over here to eat this morning, and they were trying to figure out, you know, trying to forge two or three names on that ticket over there so we could get a meal, and I just said, have her sign it. She signs anybody's name good. Best crime partner I ever had in my life, I guarantee you. She didn't drink much, didn't use much, always there, ready to drive. The only problem was she's mean. You know, there's people that are ornery, and then there's people that are mean. Just mean. And I'll tell you what, you can stand 10 women up against that wall over there, and I'll get the meanest one every time. I love them mean women. They're crazy. The crazier they are, the better I like them. There's a couple of them in here, too. I can feel it. They got up early this morning to come out here and find somebody to help. Jumped right up out of bed and meditated, said, I know he needs me. Yeah. And so we set up a little light housekeeping and didn't want to rush into anything. And after a couple of years, she said, give me an ultimatum. I don't know why sick women always want to give guys like me an ultimatum. If you don't marry me, I'm going to kick you out. No problem. I'll marry you. I didn't have no idea what the marriage vows were. Didn't make any difference. Wasn't going to study them. Wasn't going to live up to them. Didn't make any difference. I just didn't want to move out. Didn't have no place to go. So we got married, and you know, them sick women start having kids. Oh, man. Can't even handle what you got, and then you want to bring something else into it. Get a kid, you got to get a dog and a cat. I attract them sick dogs, man. I got this 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me. Sent me to obedience class with that dog. We both got kicked out of obedience class for being violent. Got a cat. We got this cat, this crazy cat. One morning I woke up one Saturday morning drunk, hungover, and she kind of says, you got to take that cat down to the vet. Okay. I figured that would be a good chance to get a drink, you know. So I got that old cat in the pickup truck, got me a jug, and he run under the seat, and I started drinking. I finally got him down to the vet and went in there and gave him to the vet, and they said, it won't take long, just wait. And I went back out in the truck, had a few more drinks. Pretty soon they waved and come get that cat, and I went and got that old cat, throwed him in that pickup truck, and that cat went all over that truck, up and down, around, clawing, scratching. They cut that sucker's balls off that morning. They neutered him. And he never forgot who took him down there. Hated me from that moment on. Every time I'd try to lay down and rest, he'd attack me. I shot at that cat a half a dozen times in my house, tried to shoot that cat, and that cat always, never could hit him. And just crazy. And everybody around there was like that. Our house was like a combat zone. And finally we had to move, in AA, they call them trips geographics, but when we moved, they called it unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. Time to get the hell out of Texas, so we went to California. And I loaded everything up, and away we went. Got the dog and the cat and, you know, all this stuff, and away we went. It took us 30 days to make a trip most people could do in three, you know. It's just crazy, you know, crazy all the time. Just fighting and raising hell and I'd get drunk, and we'd just have to stay put for a while and then wake up, and away we'd go again, rip and tear, drive for a day and a night, and then figure out we was going in the wrong direction, you know. You ever do that? You ever go someplace that's drunk and he just gives her hell, man? I don't know where we're going, but we're right on time. Just going, man, going, driving, driving, driving. Everybody in the car needs to go to the bathroom. Not me, man. I'm going to drive until I float. And you know why drunks do that? Because when you get there and let them go to the bathroom, they stay in there longer and you can drink more before they get back in the car, see? And, it's just insane. By the time we got to California, everybody was stark raving nuts. And, wherever I go, it take me, and I'm the first one to get there. And when I got there, there I was. And I moved right into a neighborhood with people just like me, more of them. And I don't know how we can find that. Alcoholics got a built-in radar. You know, I tell her we're going to leave this part of the country and get away from all these crazy people. We're going to change everything, give them the old story. You know, we're going to get there and start a new life. And all the deal, right down to the bottom line. We're going to get a job, we're going to work hard, going to take care of you, going to find a nice house, going to put everybody in there, we're going to have a new neighborhood, going to go down to church, going to get baptized. I'd been baptized, sprinkled, dipped. I'd had it all before I even moved. I was a Baptist. Well, it's a Buzzard Baptist. Buzzard Baptist, somebody, the only time they ever went to church was there's something dead or something to eat. But I told her, it's going to be different, man. We're going to be different. We're going to get there and get the deal, and it's all going to be different. And, they go right along. They believe you. And away you go. It took me 30 days to go someplace that would take you 3, and I'm telling her, oh, it's going to be different. It was. It was worse. And I found a house to move into that a bunch of crazies lived all around the neighborhood, you know, and we just set up a little light housekeeping there right away, and the insanity was just, it was just worse because where we went, why, it was just the more territory, more room to run, that's all, and new friends, and there's a bunch of hippies lived next door to us, where I'd never seen none of them down in Texas. They had them California hippies, and when we moved in there, you know, them people were taking LSD and laying in the front yard watching the sun come up and go down. Going blind, wandering around the neighborhood naked. And weird bunch of people. Never seen nothing like that down in Texas. But I went over and talked to them, and there was a couple of people over there in that house next door, one named Doc and the other named Professor. And I went over and talked to them about my drinking, because I figure anybody named Doc and Professor knew everything. And I wonder, you want to talk to people who have the information that you need. You ever notice that? Alcoholics got to go talk to people who know. And I went and kind of did a little fifth step with these guys, and they kept eating them sugar cubes, you know, and had them lights flashing. I was telling them about me, and they said, well, you may be part Indian, because your name's Drum. Well, that makes sense. Is it 1M or 2M? 1M, Drum. Oh, you got to be part Indian. And if you're part Indian, you can't drink fire water. If you drink fire water, it'll make you crazy. I said, oh, what'll I do? And they said, you should smoke tie sticks. Oh, what's that? So we'll show you. What do you do when you smoke tie sticks? So we hang around the park and wait for the ice cream truck to come by. I never wanted to hang around no park and wait for the ice cream truck. I always wanted to rob the ice cream truck. You know? Alcoholics don't want to wait for nothing. And, but I didn't figure, well, hell, I'll file that away if I ever need it. And later on I did. When I went to AA, I finally ended up in AA, and I remembered that I might be part Indian. I told him that's probably my problem. And we all have all that information in case we ever need it. You know, in case a judge asks you what's wrong with you, I had a judge ask me, he said, why do you act like you do? I don't know why people ask people like us why. If I knew why, I wouldn't be doing it. I don't know why, that's why I do it, so then I'll know why. And if I have to think about it very long, it won't be interesting, and I'll get bored with it, so then it won't make any difference, and it won't be a why, it'll be a why. Why did I? And they'll be asking it, and when they ask it, I'll just tell them whatever they want to know, and then it drives them crazy. You ever notice that? And people get crazy whenever they talk to people like us. The little vein in their forehead just pulsates. It just got crazier, and this lady got crazier, and her life got crazier, because that's the way it is. And I eventually ended up in AA, but I wasn't an alcoholic. And if you're not really an alcoholic, you're just not an alcoholic. And I wasn't really an alcoholic. Everybody said I was an alcoholic but me. I just said I had a problem. I didn't know what it was, but whatever it was, I was just on the verge of taking care of it, so it wasn't a problem. And so I went to meetings for 4 months. And if you're not an alcoholic, you got to go to meetings for a little while just to prove that you're not an alcoholic. So I went to one meeting a week for 4 months to prove I wasn't an alcoholic, and I didn't drink. Crazy all the time, but I didn't drink. And eventually I got thirsty, and so I drank. And I ended up staying drunk for the next 4 years before I finally came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that period of my life, where a lot of things happened, the insanity got worse, and there was no longer any fun. The violence got worse, and a lot of pain in my family and people around me. And I drank myself into a corner. I drank myself into a corner to where there's absolutely no place to go. And I believe my kind of an alcoholic has to get to that point. As long as there was any people enabling me, I couldn't sober up. As long as there's one man, woman, child, dog, or cat that was still enabling me, if they'd bail me out of jail, if they'd fix me one more time, if they'd nurse me back to health, if they, you know, take care of me one more time, I could not come to you and stay, much less admit that I'm an alcoholic. I ran out of friends and enemies at the same time. I really did. I run out of running room. Didn't have no other place to go. I'd been to Alcoholics Anonymous and didn't really think it'd work, but I had no other place to go. And I'm grateful that people in Alcoholics Anonymous, the old-timers, believe in Alcoholics Anonymous the way Alcoholics Anonymous is described in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. A man, a little gray-headed man, made a 12-step call on me and came to my house and introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And he took me, and he could tell that I was so sick that I could not just take a cup of coffee and go to a meeting. And he put me in this old detox with these other 38 drunks, and he told me to stay there until it was time to leave. And my wife was just crazy, and the kid was crazy, and just insane over there. They didn't know what was going on, neither did I. I gave up. You know, I believe you have to get to that point. I don't think I had a spiritual awakening necessarily at that point. I think I just gave up. And I'm not going to tell you, there's an amazing thing about my kind of an alcoholic. I don't know about you, but I can give up knowing I'd given up a long time before I gave up. But I didn't. When that guy came to my house, I didn't meet him with open arms and say, you know, I love you, I can't hardly wait to go to an AA meeting. I stuck a gun right in his face and said, if you take me back to one of them nut wards, because I'd been to them nut wards more times than I'd been anywhere else at that period of my life. I said, you can take me to the nut wards, I'm going to kill you and them and everybody else. And that little man, little Jack, he's still sober, and I talk to him once a week. He's a beautiful little man. He did something he's never done before since. He grabbed that gun out of my hand, threw it on the couch, and he said, now, if you want to commit suicide, you got a crowd. I'll wait. And he said, if you want to stay sober, come go with me. You don't ever have to take a drink again as long as you live if you don't want to. And he said, I'll give you a better deal than that. I'll add a little bit on that. And I love the old-timers know how to set the hook. And he set the hook. He said, you don't ever have to be lonely again as long as you live if you don't want to. God, I knew the loneliness. Knew that loneliness. Man, I know that loneliness. Hate that loneliness. The wind blowing through that hole in my gut. And I knew that loneliness. I had no idea how I could stop drinking. But when he said, you know, you don't ever have to be lonely again as long as you live, I bought the deal. And I followed him like a puppy dog. And he took me and put me in that detox, and I stayed in there over a month, and they finally let me out. They brought a guy in there that, you know, I don't know if you got them hospital institution things. And I'm real active in H&I work, and my wife is. We go to prisons, and both of us, and carry the message, because that's really how we got ours, through a 12-step call and institution work. And this guy, they brought these AAs over there to this old detox, and there's one little guy kept coming over there all the time. He's just always there. He went to meetings all the time. His name, they call him Rotten Ron. He's a little guy, you know. And he went to meetings all the time. He went to meetings in the morning, and he went to meetings at noon. He went to meetings in the afternoon. He went to meetings at night. He went to the late meetings. He went to the early meetings. He went to meetings all the time. And he come up to me just right before I was about ready to get out, and he said, I'm your sponsor. I said, what's that, a friend? And he said, no, if you want a friend, get a dog. I had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that hated me. And he looked me right in the eye, and he said, you know, all them guys that come in on that panel, there's about a dozen of us come in on that panel. He said, we drew straws for you, and I lost. He said, I don't like you. And I said, well, I don't like you. He said, that is not necessary. He said, I'm your sponsor, and I'll come and get you when it's time for you to leave. And so they come and got me, and they took me over to this house. Now, this house I lived in at that time, where Sue and Simone lived, my wife and daughter, there wasn't a door jamb in that house that didn't, you know, hadn't been exploded. And some of them had C-clamps, them old wood C-clamps, holding it together so you could shut the door. And it wasn't, I don't think there was a window in that house that hadn't been knocked out. There wasn't a window in that house that didn't have a hole in it, a crack in it. Most of them had tapes across it. The front door had that old press wood up on it because I just go through the front door. And the front yard didn't have no grass. It just had a lot of dandelions. You know, you could take, I'd take the old air compressor, fire it up, and take my air hose out there and mow the front yard. You just blow the tops off them dandelions, you motor. And my sponsor come and got me and took me over to the house. I run up and knocked on the front door, and Sue came to the front door, and I said, I've got to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every day for the rest of my life. What are you going to do? She just reared back and looked at me and said, well, I've been going to Alley Anon, and the kids have been going to Alley Teen, the dog's been going to Alley Dog, and the cat's been going to Alley Cat. What are you going to do, dummy? I didn't know what to say. My sponsor was backing out of the driveway, so I went in and waited long enough for him to get home, and I called him, and I said, she's going to Al-Anon. He said, good. Then it won't be necessary for you to tell her what's wrong with her ever again. I immediately thought, if I don't tell her, who will? Somebody's got to tell her what's wrong with her. But I didn't say nothing, and he said, don't you do anything, and I'll come and get you and take you to a meeting. And he started taking me to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had an old van, and it had no nothing in it. Very stripped vans. He had some old orange crates sitting in the back of it, and he'd pick up all us newcomers and start taking us to meetings. We'd sit on them orange crates, and he'd gas it at a light, and we'd all us newcomers would slide to the back of the van. Then he'd run up the next light, hit the brake, and we'd all slide up front. I just riddled with insanity when I was new. I just hate. You could just feel the hate coming out of me. People would sit down next to me at a, you know, going to a meeting, and he'd take us there early, and he'd say, we'd go in there and sit down, and I'd sit down in a meeting with a cup of coffee, and you could just feel it. You could smell the hate coming out of me. I mean, it wasn't a, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I had problems when I sobered up. I got problems. The book says waves of the past will roll over you when you get here. I had mountains of stuff. I was out there. I had problems. I owed lots of money to people who you can't write them a letter and say, I'll send you $100 a month. Every dime I owed was all due yesterday. I had this crazy woman who was going to Al-Anon who had released me. And I had this kid that was running around the house like a wounded animal. I had this sponsor that hated me. And I was riding around in this old van with a bunch of people that were nuts. Absolutely nuts. And they said I had to go to work and pay my debts. And I'm trying to figure out how to do that. And they said I had to have a spiritual experience in order to stay sober. And I'm trying to figure out how you do that. Guns all the time. And I carried guns when I sobered up. I'd have a gun in each boot, one in my belt. Sometimes I had so many guns on me, if you'd have bumped into me, there'd have been nothing but a mushroom cloud. And I'm grateful they had meetings where it's okay. Now, there's meetings, and then there's meetings, and then there's meetings. And I went to men's stag. You know, old-timers have to know how to treat certain kinds of drunks, and that's good. That's what you come here. You come here to these things. You hear the message, but you go back out into your meetings, and there's meetings that people used to said one time, they told this old-timer over on the spiritual side of town, said, what are you going to do about Keith Drum? He said, I'm going to leave him alone. He said, I'm glad he's going to that meeting on the other side of town, because if he's over there, he's leaving us alone. Because I did not sober up and everything's wonderful. I sobered up and I'm stark raving nuts. I wanted to drink all the time. I would sit in the meetings and they'd call on me a couple of times. And then they wouldn't let me share no more. Because all I could talk about is, I want to drink. I want to drink. All I think about is wanting to drink. If you think about wanting to drink, then you talk about wanting to drink, then you just think more about wanting to drink. And they said, don't talk about that. Don't say nothing. You can come to these meetings and you say you're an alcoholic, and anything after that, just circumstantial evidence. And they wouldn't let me say nothing for a year. They wouldn't let me read. They wouldn't let me do nothing. My sponsor would take me to these meetings. I'd go to these meetings. I finally snuck off and went to meetings up in Wyoming. After I was about 8 or 9 months sober, I went to meetings up in Wyoming. Got away from my sponsor a little while trying to work, and I went to meetings up in Wyoming at the Evanston State Wyoming Nut Board. You can be a spiritual giant up there without even going a year. Most of those people are on Thorazine. They just walk around and blow little bubbles, you know. I'd talk to this one guy about God. He'd blow little bubbles and kind of look at me. And I became a spiritual giant up there, and I couldn't hardly wait to get home and tell my wife about my spiritual experience, you know. She'd already had one. Al-Anons do that, you know. They always have the spiritual experience before the alcoholic. She had it. She was so happy that she had it. She had to tell me about it, and I was so mad that she had it first. I said, I'm supposed to have the spiritual experience first. She said, well, I don't know when you're going to have yours. I've had mine. And so I went back up to the Nut Ward, and I talked to those people about that. And after going to meetings up there a little while, I come home and I told her, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. I've saved myself for you. You know how we are when we sober up. And she said, I've done a sex inventory in them Al-Anon meetings and I'm with my sponsor, and I've discovered that you haven't made love to me in 10 years. You've raped me on a regular basis. That's a hell of a way to treat a spiritual giant. You know that? She said, matter of fact, tonight you're sleeping on the couch. So I went in and laid down on the couch, and I'm thinking about all this. And about midnight, them hippies next door started mowing their backyard. And she come running down the hallway and said, they're out there mowing their backyard. I said, the hell they are, running down the hallway, grab my old 44 mag, run out and leaned over the fence and blowed that hippie's lawnmower all to hell. His eyes that big around, man. An old 44 flashed and blew that lawnmower up. Next day or two, them hippies moved out of the neighborhood. I was single-handedly cleaning up a neighborhood that had been corrupt for years. She took me in there and throwed one on me and said, I just love you when you're a hero. Never can figure them out. I know that sounds crazy, but that's the way I was when I was new. I'd go to these men's stag meetings because they, you know, their native tongue was profanity. I didn't come here and say, you got to quit cussing. I would have imploded. I didn't know how to express myself unless I had this. And I'm grateful the old timers that were around me knew where to take me. They took me to meetings where that's okay. They took me to men's stag meeting. And I'd sit in there, I'd just be able to run this insanity out. And these guys, oh, they had some sick dudes in there. I could tell. After you've been sober a little while, you can tell who's sick and who ain't. And a couple of these guys were sick. And I'd sit in there and I'd think, I'm going to kill that guy. I'm going to do the world a favor. And I'd take while he'd be shearing, I'd take my old gun out of my boot, an old 44, and I'd take my bullet out, and I'd take the Pentatel pen. And I'd write his name on that bullet while he's talking. I'd hold it up, and I'd say, I'm going to kill you after the meeting. You know how alkies are. You can't scare them. They just keep telling that trash, you know, and dumping it. Then the meeting would be over, and they'd say the closing prayer, and I'd forget which one I was going to kill first. This sober cop, gave me an old grenade. He said, here, when it gets bad enough, put this in your mouth and pull the pin. For you, that'll be a fifth step. They were not nice to me. I figured next week I'm going to come back and throw this grenade in here and kill them all. And they'd hug me. They'd grab me and hug me and hold on. Oh, I hated that. God, I hate that. I hated it. Now I just love to hug them newcomers. You know, they just try to get away from me. Boy, them guys that hold on to me and I just try to get away, you know. They told me, you know, you know, they said things like, you got to work the steps. I did an immoral inventory. Got to do that first, get it out of the way. I mean, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard. That big book says men and women drink for the effect. The effect is after some amount of consumption, you can't distinguish the difference true and false, right and wrong. That's the definition of a sociopath, that somebody does not have a conscience. And then you come here and sober up and say, do a moral inventory. How can you do a moral inventory if you don't know the difference between right and wrong? So you have to do an immoral inventory first. And the reason you have to do that is so you can try to impress the old-timers. You can't impress them. You ever try that? I'd tell them some of my sick stuff. And as soon as I'd give them my best shot, they'd tell me something sicker. I told that guy one time, I said, I know some of that stuff you told me had to be a lie, because some of that stuff you said you did, I went home and tried doing. You can't do it. Physically, you can't do it. I sobered up, and I've been with this lady all this time, and she's going down and on. The kid's going to Alateen, and I mean, that was not an easy thing. The kid didn't want to go to Alateen, and I said, you got to go to Alateen. I got to go to AA. You got to go to Alateen. The whole family's been sentenced here. And she cried, and she'd go drink that Tabasco sauce and mustard water and throw up. I just get an old coffee can and say, get in the car. And she'd come out of them Al-Anon meetings, their Alateen meetings. She'd say, all they talk about in there is sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I'd laugh. Sounds like home, don't it? We made that kid. Sue took her to most of the meetings, and I intimidated her. She was young enough to be intimidated at the time, 12 and a half, 13 years old, and we made her go to Alateen. And I'm so grateful we did that. She hated us for a year and a half, and that was okay. She hated us anyway. And I think it's very hypocritical, just my opinion, but I don't see how anybody could come to this program and reap the rewards of this way of life and deny their children of the same thing. You know, how could you be so pompous to come here and find a spiritual way of life that turns your whole life around and gives you everything you ever wanted, and then say, I can't make my kid go to Alateen because I've hurt him enough? Jesus. You know, my daughter today is one of the very, very successful model. And she lives in Milan, Italy. She works for some of the greatest clothes designers in the world. She's a ramp model. And she comes out on a ramp and models these clothes. And she walks around this room and in front of people from all nations, send buyers there to these big Paris fashion shows and some of those things. You can't come out of the disease of alcoholism to that ramp model without living this way of program. The rejection will kill you. It's like trying to be a movie star. I mean, many times they'd have her, you know, she'd go for these, trying to get a job as a model, and she didn't have the look that they wanted, so they just get out of here. And until she could apply the principles in this program in her life, could she understand that she didn't have to take that personal. And once she could do that and let the program work in her life, why, she's become a successful model. So you see, I don't tell you she's a successful model so I can tell you that it's a success story. I'm telling you, I told that goddamn kid she had to go to Alateen. And as a result of that, she became a successful model. And a good member of Al-Anon. See? Very active member of Al-Anon today. And she'll tell you that, see? And that's the way I was when I sobered up. I gotta go, you gotta go. And, you know, I rained my wrath on people around there. I mean, I didn't necessarily try to sober up everybody in the neighborhood, but in the same way with Sue's drinking. Sue's not an alcoholic. But she, you know, they told her when I sobered up, said, you know, you can't make everybody around you not drink. And like I told you, I wanted to drink all the time. All the time. And Sue enjoyed having a beer with Mexican food or, you know, a little wine with pizza or something, you know. She enjoyed the taste. She tried to drink them with me a couple of times, but she'd get sick and all that stuff. But, you know, drinking was a part of her life. And they told me when I sobered up, I couldn't make her, you know, I couldn't deprive her of that. I can't go turn the TV off just because they got a beer commercial. I mean, all them things were questions when I was new that were driving me crazy. And here, you know, we'd go out to eat and Sue'd order a drink. And I'd just sit there and look at it. And, you know, she might take a sip. One of the things, and she'd have them take it away. One of the things when I was sobered up, you know, I mean, they told me certain principles. I had to learn what the marriage vows were. There were certain principles, family principles. My sponsor told me, he said, you know, you come in here and be wonderful in one of these meetings for an hour and a half or an hour, whatever it is around here, that's great. But what are you doing at home? That's where you got sick. That's where you got to get, you know, recovery. And they pounded those kind of principles on me that I got to change in that area. And that I can't run around on my wife. And I can't, you know, do a lot of the things that I used to do. There's a lot of physical violence in that home. And when I sobered up, the physical violence had to leave, just like abstinence from alcohol. People said, what'd you do with that anger? I used to run home and we'd have that physical fight. Matter of fact, Sue and I got to the point that we couldn't make love unless we'd beat the hell out of each other previously. Because you have to make, I mean, there are some sick relationships like that, and that's the way ours was. The only problem was is that now I'm sober and we cannot have this physical violence. It's unacceptable. if I do that, I'm going to drink, because once I got that kind of anger going, I'd get so blinded by the anger, you could stick a drink in my hand and I'd drink it. I wouldn't even know. And that abstinence from that physical violence had to come the same as abstinence from alcohol. And when I had that awareness, my sponsor explained that to me. You'd go home and you get in that fight and punch her, and then the guilt would come, and then you'd leave and go drink. You can't stay sober if you go home from a meeting and punch your old lady. And I went home, and she started getting my face and that stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I said, get out of my face. And she took one step closer like she always did. And I said, get out of my face. I'm not going to hit you anymore. I can't hit you and stay sober. You're going to have to fix yourself. The fight's over. Now them games that I used to run out at the house and she's running, the jig's up. And I had to make those kind of changes in order to stay sober. And I'm grateful that there's people in Alcoholics Anonymous that taught me those things. And they said, well, I said, what do I do with this thing? I said, you go to meetings early, set the chairs up, you go, you know, clean up the coffee pots, you clean up the cups, you set it out, you go down and, you know, go on 12-step calls. I went on 12-step calls. My sponsor went on 12-step calls all the time. He'd take me on 12-step calls. We'd go on these 12-step calls, you know. And I'd go to a motel and some guy'd be drunk, everybody's left, and, you know, he'd lost his job and everything else, need help real bad, and I'd sit there, I was new, I'd listen to all this stuff, my sponsor talked to him, pretty soon that old drunk get up, look under the bed. Then he didn't need us anymore. I don't know what he had under, he either found his billfold or found that bottle of the keys to his car, but he didn't need us anymore, I knew that, and we'd get in the car and leave, and I'd think, well, what, you know, and he'd just take me on these 12-step calls all the time. And I'm trying to work the steps myself. I'm trying to find out about me. I owed all this money. I had to go borrow some money and try to pay my debts, and I tried to do the right thing. My wife went to Al-Anon, and she never did deprive me of the privilege of making my financial amends to other people. She has never deprived me of that privilege, I'll guarantee you. It's your debt. You make it. You pay it. And that's the way they taught me. They said, if you borrowed $100... That amends is not made until you give that guy $100. Saying, I'm sorry, ain't going to cut it. And my wife was working and doing these things and working a program so that I could do those things. And she went to a Christmas party and she had a couple of drinks. She come home, I just went crazy. I said, where you been? She said, I went to a Christmas party and had a couple of drinks. And I said, can't handle it. What are you going to do now? She said, I'm going to go lead an Al-Anon meeting. Just drove me crazy. Just went crazy. You know, because we'd try to change some of those things. When I'd leave, I'd kiss her goodbye. When I come home, I'd kiss her, and she'd have booze on her breath. I couldn't kiss her. They were supposed to have healing in that home, and she's got booze breath. Besides that, I went and talked to this old-timer, and he said, you can't kiss them drunk girls, mouth and stay sober. It'll make you thirstier. And I told her, I said, you know, I'm going to kill you. You know, people say you don't have, you know, you can't stop everybody around you from drinking. You can't, you know, have to get all the booze out of the house. I can't drink. That's chapter 3 says the great illusion of every alcoholic is, you know, return to normal drinking. And you're going to having a cocktail here, or going to a party there, having a drink, come home, want to kiss me on the lips with that booze breath, and it's driving me crazy. She went over to her sponsor's house and did an inventory on that. Come home, she said, I did an inventory on that, and my sponsor and I discovered very simple thing. Why would I want to put something on me that has caused me so much pain all these years? So as of right now, I'm never going to drink again. How the hell can you do that? How can you just quit like that? She said, because I'm not an alcoholic. She just quit. Never had a drink since. Been 14, 15 years. That just drove me crazy. First I was crazy because she'd go out and have one drink. Then I was crazy how could you just stop like that? And taught me a lot of things. We had no booze in our house. You know, I didn't know what was going on. I did the inventory, did all that stuff. She went and got involved in service. Her and my daughter got involved in service, and they didn't die. So I tried it. And then they went and got involved in the steps, and they didn't die. And so I tried it. You know, tell my sponsor. My wife and daughter just went and did their inventory, and they feel better. My sponsor said, well, why don't you try it? And so I tried it, and I felt better. And amazing thing, we were trucking right along there, you know, doing the right thing, and I didn't know, you know, by the time I was 3 years sober, I'd start raving insane. Just crazy. Because ain't nothing worse than having a deal and not knowing what to do with it. So here I am, I'm 3 years sober, I'm just trucking along, I've done the steps, working things, trying to do this thing at home, being faithful to my wife, you know, paying the bills, and paying my financial amends, and I'm just nuts. I'd sit in meetings and I hear people talk about how it's wonderful and everything's fine. And I cleaned up my act a little bit. You know, my sponsor took me down with some guy he sponsored, and they got me a nice set of threads, you know, and he got me a nice car, a big AA car. If you've been here a couple of 3 years, you got to get you a big AA car, you know, park it right in front of the meeting so the newcomers will have hope, you know. They got me all fixed up. I was ready. And I was standing in this meeting one day, and I didn't know what was going on. I was just crazy, standing there with my grenade in my hand, just trying to figure out what I'm sticking my mouth and blowing my head off. You know, I was just nuts. And I love the old-timers that, you know, they know the timing. They know when you're ready, man. They know when you're ripe. They know when it's time. And I was standing in this meeting, and I looked around. This weirdo standing next to me, the worst-looking guy I'd ever seen. I'd seen him in a meeting the night before. He was a treasurer of the meeting, and they'd ask him to give a treasurer's report. And he stood up and said, "I stole the money, and I ain't paying it back." He's standing next to me, and his hair is sticking out everywhere. I had one of them little welder's caps on with strawberry and cherries on it, you know, goofy little guy. You know, I was kind of waiting for some doctor, lawyer, parole officer, or cop, or somebody to come along and ask me to be their sponsor. You know, I was just waiting for somebody special, and this guy pulls up beside me, and I said, "Why don't you comb your hair?" And he said, "I did." And it just stuck out everywhere. He'd give himself a permanent, just had things hanging out, you know. You know. And his head looked like he'd fired up one of them $5 cigars and then rammed it into the wall, just kind of. And he wasn't short enough to be a man or tall enough to be a midget. Just weird, you know, just weird. You know, and I said, "What do you want?" And he said, "Will you be my sponsor?" I said, "Oh, Jesus, man, I can't even take care of myself." And I went over to my sponsor. I told this weirdo, I said, "Here, hold my grenade, you know what I mean?" I go over to my sponsor, who stood on the other side of the room. My sponsor wouldn't stand next to me. I went over there and I said, "See that weirdo over there?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, he just asked me to be his sponsor." And my sponsor says, "Yeah, I know. I sent him over there." "Would you go back and tell him you'll be his sponsor and do exactly what he says?" And that didn't make sense to me then or now, but I didn't argue with him. And I went back over to this weirdo and I said, "My sponsor says I got to be your sponsor. What do you want to do?" And he said, "I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln." I got him in the car, and we started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'd go to them meetings all the time, and he'd talk that sick stuff all the way to the meeting, all the way home, and then right before he'd get to the house, he'd say, "You ever do anything like that?" And I said, "Yeah." And I'd start telling him some of my sick stuff, and he'd say, "Man, you're the sickest sucker I know, man. We need help, you know." And I'd say, "Okay, I'll come get you tomorrow night," and I'd go get him next night, and I'd start taking the meetings. An amazing thing, you know, I was telling that guy to do things that, you know, I knew I should be doing, and I started applying those things in my own home because I was telling him to do it. And he started asking me questions out of the book, so I had to read the book, and he started asking me questions that I didn't know where the answers were, so I had to go to my sponsor, and he'd give me questions. And I didn't know that my sponsor was telling this guy the questions. That's why sponsors always know the answers, because they send that goof over here to ask you. You ever notice that? They call that the chain of sponsorship. All that means is that your sponsor is telling your baby what to ask you. So you'll have to go to him and ask him the answer to the question, which he already knew because he sent the question. Drives you crazy. I said, "How do you know all this shit?" I thought he was smart. He just had a list of questions. And this guy was just crazy and an amazing thing. He ended up going up at my house, and he couldn't read or write, and we started working the steps together that one day, and he started talking, and I started writing. I literally wrote his fourth step, and he verbalized it to me, and I wrote it all down to ask him questions, and then he asked me that stupid thing, you know, "Did you ever do anything like this?" And I started thinking about a couple of things I'd forgotten to tell my sponsor when I did my fifth step, and I knew God was in the room, and he couldn't read it, so I just put some of my stuff in his. What the hell? It's what it's all about, getting it out, you know, and we burn it, and, you know. And that's what the whole deal is, one drunk talking to another drunk. That guy jumped up and hugged me and said, "I love you." And I've been doing that, you know, from that day to this. This yesterday evening, while a couple of guys, I sponsor, and a couple of guys they sponsor, one or two of them, took Sue and I to the airport to come here. And there'll be a couple of them there to meet us when we come home. And, you know, our whole life is full of people that love us, and we love them. Now, you can say, you know, that's sponsorship, or you can say that's the program, or you can say a lot of things, but the bottom line is it's people that we love and that love us. And coming from a guy who, you know, lived for many years under the illusion that the only way I was making a successful was to make an enemy a day, to a complete 180-degree turn to the point that, you know, today without even realizing that I meet people that that love me and I love them every day. Every day I'm with people like that. And it's amazing, you know, the different perspective of my life and of what I see in life by just changing that. It's a change of attitude. It's something, if you're new or relatively new, it takes time, and it took me time. It didn't really make any difference if all the people I sobered up with didn't make it. It didn't make any difference, you know, if my sponsor decided not to do it anymore and he had to go and drink. It didn't make any difference if the group that I went to, you know, broke up. It didn't make any difference if a lot of things changed in Alcoholics Anonymous, because a lot of changes in Alcoholics Anonymous, people, places, and things. The difference is that I've found a program that I've tried to adapt my life to, and I've changed. See, that's the whole ball of wax. You know, the same man will drink again. That's what they told me. And if I don't say nothing else, I'm going to tell you this. The same man or lady will drink again. You've got to change. A drunk, an alcoholic is just a drunk with a conscience. And you come here and these steps and these principles in our life, we start applying them. And I can stand here and tell you that I love that lady more than I've ever loved anyone. And the reason is because we have longevity. We've been together for 32 years. We've been together. 16 years of drunkenness and 16 years of sobriety. And there's certain values and certain actions that go with that. If you come here and apply these principles in your life, it's not just, oh, I found AA and Al-Anon and everything's going to be wonderful. That's an illusion. To come here and find this program is a way of life. And you come here and you take the actions as a result of the actions. After taking the actions for some period of time, it becomes a way of life. And what I have in that relationship with the people that I live with and that lady is trust. I love it when a newcomer comes here and said, I'll do my fifth step, but I don't trust anyone. That's probably the most honest thing they can say. Because they're not trustworthy. You can't trust anyone if you're not trustworthy. If you're a liar, cheat, and a thief, you're never going to be able to trust anybody. You see, being a thief, it's not that I'm afraid I'm going to steal or what I'm going to steal is being a thief means that I don't trust myself. God, what a deception. And I come here and I apply these principles in my life, and little by little I've had to change. And I haven't cheated on that lady since May 11, 1976. What we have is trust. What that gives us is a bond. If you're new or relatively new, I don't know about you and you're kind of an alcoholic, but I'll tell you about mine. I couldn't come here and trust God and then take that out and apply it in my life. I had to come here and learn to trust you. In learning to trust you, I learned to trust me. And when I learned to trust me, I took those actions and those principles and applied it in my daily affairs and developed a relationship and a value with the people around me and then discovered I trust my God because I am taking the actions with the people around me. And then I recognize that I'm taking those actions and I have that faith with a power greater than me. If you're new or relatively new, don't look for something that isn't here. Come here and hang on. Hold on to this deal. I woke up one day and it dawned on me. I get up very early every morning, 4 o'clock every morning. And I hit the deck and I hit them streets out there and I hold my head up with a little dignity, some I didn't know anything about. And I walk around out there all day and I mix with the best ones, the tall ones, short ones, the rich ones, and the poor ones. And I walk out there on that day, I got a job and I show up for that job and I got a boss and I treat him with respect. I got a boss that's worked the same job for 50 years. You imagine that? 50 years. You don't know nothing. Dumbest guy I ever seen. But I learned in here to treat you. If you say you got 30 years or 50 years, you tell me you got 50 years of sobriety, I'll hang around you long enough to validate it, and then I'll trust you and I'll respect it, no matter what you do in your personal life. And I learned that in here, and that's the way I can treat my boss. As a result of that, there's some people I sponsor have been able to get a job and they've been able to go to work and apply the same principles in their life. Because of that, I can make it through a full day. You know, we say we do it one day at a time. Come here and you do it one day at a time. That's all you got to do. But there's more to it than that. You'll know that this principles of this program is working in your life when you look back on the day at the end of the day and your head's laying on that pillow You know beyond a shadow of a doubt. You've been out there on the streets all day long. You've been mixing with the best of them. And you ain't had to crawl before nobody, man. You've held your own. Admit when you're wrong and carry the rest on down the road with a little self-worth. At the end of that day, your head laying on that pillow, you look back on that day and you know one thing beyond a shadow of a doubt. You ain't seen nobody or thought of nobody you'd rather be than yourself. That's the deal. That's what I look for in every dream. Be able to make it through one day, and hold my head up. I didn't have to outthink, outperform, or outmaneuver nobody, man. I just had to walk out there on them streets and hold my head up. Walk with a little dignity. Let a little sunlight shine in somebody else's life. Do something for somebody else. Not have to get a stroke for it, but to know 2 inches behind my belly button, I did something to make somebody else's day a little better. And I can do the things like that at one day at a time. And I've had a lot of good days. I've had some painful days, but I had me a lot of good days in 16 years. And I can stand here and tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt, what you give me, you can't buy. You have to earn it. I heard a guy say when I was relatively new, he said, I love you all. And I thought, man, you don't know me. You don't know me. If you knew me, you couldn't say that. I can stand here today. I've stayed here long enough to say I love you all. And the reason I can say that is because not what you are individually, but collectively, when you come to places like that and I'm with you, what I am when I'm with you is what makes me love you. Because on one cold day, you took a stumble bum drunk like me and said, come in. Come on in, you're welcome. You're home. Not knowing I believed. I believed because I saw something I'd never seen before. I saw the sweet smell of success. And it wasn't a sign or a big car or a dollar sign. It was a simple guy standing there saying, look at me, man. I made it today and I didn't have to pick up a drink. I didn't have to sell my soul for a drink. I didn't have to crawl on my knees to beg you to get back in my own house. How'd you like to have that, kid? And I said, I'd give anything and everything for that. And he said, that's what it'll cost you. Because it won't take much, just every damn thing you got and then some. But then it'll be worth it. Because then one day you'll be able to walk out there and hold your head up and know beyond a shadow of a doubt you're who you always wanted to be, just being yourself. If you're new or relatively new, you're here, you may not want what I got. But I'll go home tonight and pray like hell. You stay until you want what you got. God bless and thank you.